I'm Dr. Ralph Ford, and you're listening to Barron Talks. My guests today are from Viking Plastics. Viking Plastics is an injection molding and assembly service company headquartered right here in northwestern PA in the city of Cory. And Viking Plastics manufactures plastics and rubber sealing enclosures. They offer custom injection molding and assembly and post-molding services for a variety of industries, very notably the automotive and HVAC sectors. And I will also add a longtime partner and friend of Penn State Barron as a company and as individuals. But joining us here today, we're actually interviewing two people today, Kelly Goodsell, the president and CEO of Viking Plastics, and Sean Gross. Sean is a graduate of Penn State Barron, and he has the somewhat unique title of Vice President of Culture and Business Development. So welcome here, gentlemen.
Thank you. Morning.
Appreciate you joining us. Well, let's just, you know, I always like to hear, let's hear about the origin story. So let's go back to the origin of Viking Plastics back in 1972 and the sort of projects you created at that point and the early growth of the business.
Sean, I know you weren't there at that time. Yeah. You want to start?
It predates me a little bit. It's a twinkle in someone's eye, maybe, at that point. But back when plastics was blossoming in this region, the founders of Viking Plastic, I think there were four or five of them at the time, had started other businesses in Erie County, and Viking was, kind of a successive business here. We're going to start another one because go to plastics, right? Start a business and you're going to make it happen. So that's why it's in Cory, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. The founding people were in this region. They had some businesses up here in Erie, and it sounded as though at that time they wanted to start something in southern Erie County. I think there were some ties at that time to the Cory region.
And you've stayed there ever since. You've never left Cory as your corporate headquarters.
No, we've got a great workforce, a great team in Cory. Community's been great. A great place to raise a family. So we've been headquartered there. We have obviously branched out to our other facilities in Indiana, Kentucky, and then we've got relationships with companies in China and Brazil as well. I've lived there for 20 years. Sean's been in Northwest Pennsylvania all his life, and so it's a great place. Why not Cory?
Yeah, and a tremendous amount of civic pride and a lot going on these days. As we look forward, as we come out of the pandemic, we hear good stories about what's happening in Cory.
Absolutely.
And, I wanted to jump back into your history as well. In the 1980s, of those of us who remember, the unfortunate Tylenol tragedy, with people putting poison into some of the Tylenol pills when we didn't, frankly, have that technology to prevent tamper-proof containers. But you played a role in that. I mean, your company did. Could you tell us, what was that? How did you play a role in that?
Sure. So we had a product line that lots of people knew as Clark Container, another regional company, and we made pill bottles as well as the lids, the anti-access lids that you have to push and twist and turn, and you get harder as you get older.
Yeah.
Those products were made for a number of years in Cory at our facility. At one point, it became a real commodity market. If you weren't making millions and millions and millions of those on a daily basis, then you weren't able to compete, and that business kind of went away from us. But it was an interesting time, I'm sure.
But the design of that product as well, something that really you probably can't easily do with other materials. Plastics is well suited to creating that sort of a rip-off enclosure, is my guess, that makes it possible.
Absolutely.
So you are also in a whole other range of markets, from engine parts to HVAC, outboard motors in boats, vehicles, so in the average vehicle, can you give us a sense of the scope and scale? Where do we find your products?
Sure. Sean, you want to?
Yeah, so I think it's, I like making stuff. I always tell people that, as an engineer, it's really neat to be in manufacturing. And when you walk through our plant, you see parts that are going to go globally, right? They're going to go ship around the world, go into automotive spaces, where you're under the hood, components where, you have high heat applications and the need to seal things like in the air conditioning system. So from my perspective, you see this evolution with Viking over the years, the decades, that cap, has turned into business where we're producing millions of caps that are going into the automotive industry. with unscrewing threads and tamper evidence and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. The pride I have is when I, you know, have a customer come and they say, well, what do you make for us, right? We have all these different customers. And literally a couple of weeks ago, we had a power outage in the community, and we had a big customer in, and you know, what are you making for us? So, hey, pop the hood of this vehicle, and we'll start pointing it out, you know? So it's kind of, I think, a neat thing to have in northwestern Pennsylvania, the ability to make stuff, right, that's going around the world and going into some pretty cool applications.
Well, I think that's one of the things that I came here 27 years ago, and it's just very, very characteristic of the region. We have great tradespeople, great designers, great manufacturers. People just know how to make things here.
Right.
And you can't take that for granted in a whole lot of communities.
Absolutely.
Now, I just wanted to follow up a little bit more. Plastics and automotive, I don't know what it is, but probably they reduce about a third of the weight, at least in an automobile. I don't know if you know what that number is. The reduction in terms of fuel consumption that
sure.
that creates and the use in battery technology is quite significant.
There's a big drive for it. We engage heavily with our various customers. I mean, if it moves and it has an energy efficiency standard, if it, you know, whether it's a compressor, you know, mm-hmm. you think about a geothermal unit with a compressor system, the ability to gain 3 or 5% energy improvement is monumental to them. It's transformative for their business. And we've done that with companies. The automobile, lightweighting is a buzzword. You know, how do we mm-hmm. take this metal component and use polymer technology to reduce it? An example is a steering column. You have a cast aluminum or a machined aluminum housing that now we can turn into a thermoplastic and reduce pounds out of a vehicle and do it for less money, right? So it's kind of a win-win situation that, you know, that we get engaged in with them. But it requires a lot of technical knowledge. Oh. You know, you got to understand the strengths of the materials and where they are going to play the role and where they're going to succeed and where we've got to overcome some challenges.
The variety and the number of plastics materials, I'm not an expert in this, but I know enough to know it's very great. And then you get into issues of thermal management and thermal
Absolutely.
Properties that you have in that are very demanding. So it's always pushing the edge of the technology. And I wanted to switch to, I mean, and follow up on that. Kelly, you know, General Motors has awarded you the designation of Platinum Supplier and selected you for their Supplier Quality Excellence Award. So congratulations. They've
Thank
done
you.
That the last 7 years. Clearly you're doing something right.
Yeah, so all the credit goes to the team of individuals that make the product, ship the product on time. General Motors, you may have heard, is a tough customer.
Mm-hmm.
They are the biggest producer in the world. They're the guys that pound the hardest when they need price decreases or need better service. You know, it's a testament to not only our people and capabilities, but the underlying systems that make that process work, right? So you can have great systems, but if the people don't execute it on a daily basis, the very little details of making sure that the machine's running, to make sure the mold got PM, to make sure that the customer got the right communication, if you don't have the people doing that, you're going to slip up and you're going to fail, and GM is, you know, pretty punitive when you fail. So we're extremely proud of the recognition. 7 out of the last 8 years we've won that award. And actually one of the customers that visited just a couple weeks ago was a General Motors representative looking at Viking for more business. So
that's good news.
You know, it's a nice cycle, right? If you perform well, you get more business, and that's what we're all about.
Yeah, and their problems that become your problems, and they don't really care.
Exactly.
I've watched this cycle work.
That is definitely one way of looking at it, yes.
but I mean, clearly you're meeting them and doing a great job. Well, I think that really then speaks to your workforce, and you talked about the team. And so what are the skills and qualities that you look for when you're looking at new hires, and what's the talent look like?
Yeah, so obviously in today's environment, whether you're operating a Dairy Queen or a manufacturing company or a university, talent acquisition, finding good people, finding great people to come to your company has been a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to continue to be a challenge for the foreseeable future, in our opinion. So we spend a lot of time developing our people. Sean will talk about our culture and our drumbeat process, but mm-hmm. educating our people and making sure that they understand our business, make sure they understand how they can impact our business on a positive, in a positive way, is really a cornerstone to why we've been successful and we've had lower than average turnover and why we continue to do well for customers like General Motors.
Well, let's switch to that question of, I was intrigued, what is this drumbeat process that you have each and every day that with your employees?
Yeah, so several years ago, you know, back after the 2008-2009 recession, you know, which seems like a lifetime ago when you consider COVID, if you were a survivor in the automotive supply base, right, you were then being force-fed with a fire hydrant, and talk about those systems and maintenance of them, and there were challenges, right, with the workforce instability at that time, what businesses had to do, and Viking weathered that storm, but you come out of it, and you've got some brokenness in your systems, and we were really looking for something to sink our teeth into. I mean, people talk about going lean, right, the idea of we all got to go get the 150-page policy deployment manual on lean manufacturing. And over the years, you get forced into those situations by customers, and it just doesn't stick, right? It's like, we're just trying to make this business work. So we came across a methodology, a philosophy, really, called two-second lean. And it seemed like something. We watched a video. Kelly and I, we both argue about who found it first. I say he did. He says I did. But it really got us excited about what we thought we could be. And it's very simple. We teach our people to see value and waste in what they do, right? Our customers pay us to transform plastic raw materials into parts that they can utilize. And we wrap a whole bunch of things around that in our processes that don't add value. You know, the idea of movement, of transportation, of storing things that don't add value. So we want to train people to see waste. And then we ask everybody to just be an improver, to make a small 2-second improvement in something that frustrates or bugs them every day. It could be, I never have a broom where I need a broom, right? And we put up with that craziness for decades as businesses and organizations. We wallow in that waste and we say that's just the way it is. But we start to break that cycle and say, I want you to make some small change. We get wrapped up in the $10,000 or $15,000 improvements. You know, businesses go after those. We want everybody making some small improvement every day. And then the third is to share them. And when we share those, we do that at our, we call it our drumbeat meeting. So everybody's expected to attend one of our four drumbeat meetings. And that is really the backbone of our culture and our lean journey. And we work to be a very transparent company. We talk about our sales. How many dollars did we ship yesterday? Was it on time? Did the customers get what they expected from a quality perspective? What did anybody complain? Did we have anything that we found internally that we didn't do correctly? We educate the workforce every day. One of the forms of waste, the eight forms of waste. And, you know, we actually quiz ourselves, you know, it's like, hey, does everybody know these wastes and can you point to them? And then people share those 2-second improvements. They yell them out in our drumbeat meeting. Hey, I found this tool, you know, it was laying over here. It didn't have a home. And now I labeled it and I labeled the home. It's very simple things that eliminate thousands and thousands of paper cuts that as manufacturers, we've just put up with for years. So that drumbeat meeting process is our ability to get alignment, to educate our employees and our workforce, and I'm a part of that, right? I'm not only bringing stuff to the drumbeat meeting, I'm learning from my peers, and Kelly's standing out there, you know, shoulder to shoulder with the newest operator, and it really breaks down some of those barriers that we've historically had and allows us to be more aligned as a company. So it's a pretty cool process, one that I highly recommend, and we talk on it everywhere we can.
You know, so every day you have these meetings?
Every day.
Every single day?
Every day.
So
for
at seven,
the last 10 years,
7 o'clock in the morning when first shift comes in. At 8:30, we catch some of the office and other employees that come in at different times, 3 p.m. and 11 p.m. And it's the first thing that we're conditioned to do is to go learn about our business, to share, to look at how we can make it a little bit better.
You know what a great idea, because everyone gets overwhelmed with okay, you've got this whatever the target is, but it's never you can bite. You know, you can't go after it in one chunk. So this idea, a little bit of improvement every day, it adds up, and then it becomes exponential, that growth.
When you think about the conversion of people, the transformation of, hey, we're hiring a body, right? Yeah, I've heard that in my career. We need another body to fill a spot versus the investment we're making in that person who they have their own desires and dreams and, you know, things they'd like out of their career. Where before it's like, you know, just be a number, fill this spot, stand at this machine, you know, move this material. But now, hey, I want you to be a process engineer for us. We don't just have process engineers, which we do, you know, have the formal title, but we all do from the standpoint of we're here to learn and grow and make it better every day. And it, so many people get excited about that. We've had people that have come to us and said, you know, I wish the last place I worked at had done this. Mm-hmm. Because they're not in existence anymore. And what a powerful statement, right? That an operator who comes in, who's, you know, worked for 10 years in other manufacturing spaces, recognizes the value of that process to their career and where they're, you know, going to be going in life.
And it sounds to me like Kelly and Sean, both of you are out there on the factory floor each day.
Absolutely. It's not a, here's the program, go do it for everybody else. It is literally a all hands on deck, every person, Rob Elchinski, our operations manager, myself, the quality manager, everybody in the company. When our sales guy from Detroit shows up, he goes to all the drumbeat meetings. It's and with technology, it's been even better because now every day our people in Detroit remotely, virtually call in, mm-hmm. and so they're able to participate as well.
Wow.
And you know, the two of these kind of tie together. So your question about how is, you know, hiring people and, you know, retaining people working versus the culture side of it. So if a new employee comes into our facility and their experience the first week or two is a good experience because the bathrooms are labeled and somebody walks them around and shows them how to do their job and it's easy, it's an easy environment to work in, they're going to be more happy, they're going to be more satisfied than if they go to a plant and the first thing they do is they say, hey, Joe, where am I supposed to do this? And Joe says, I don't know. We never know where that is. Mm-hmm. I can't find a pen. I can't do this. I can't do that. That feeling of satisfaction helps us retain people and bring people in. And they go tell their friends.
It's our reputation for sure.
Yeah.
It becomes what we're known for.
It is that, you know, you're empowering them to make the decisions to make the company better.
Right. Absolutely.
What you do. Well, I want to switch back to Baron a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, you have a number of Baron graduates working at Viking Plastics. So
we do.
I'm asking in a very self-serving way. You know, you can tell me the truth. Are they a good fit for the company? What is it you see in our graduates?
Well, so let me give a commercial and then I'll turn it over to Sean. So,
thank you.
I am one of the outsiders at Viking Plastics because I actually graduated from Ferris State, which is a well-known plastics program, as well as Pitt State and Lowell Mass. And so every time there's a mistake on the floor, there might be a joke, whether it's a Penn State mistake or a Ferris sure. mistake. But no, the quality of talent coming out of Penn State has been awesome for a number of years. Sean's a perfect example, and Sean's up here, I don't know, twice a year, I think, with the recruiting process?
Yep. Recruiting and doing a little guest speaking for one of Brad Johnson's classes, you know, bringing freshmen in and talking to them a little bit about what not to do and how to embrace this.
Well, I will say thank you because, you know, as a faculty member here as well, I often, and by the way, I have industry experience. I worked at IBM and I worked at one of the national labs for a while, but I could tell the students, but when they hear it from somebody from industry, it does make a difference.
Right.
We might have the same message, but you've got some different and very current perspectives. So thank you for doing that and coming in and meeting with them. It does mean a lot, but I'm just going to switch back to Kelly here for a second and say, okay, so you said the very nice things, but you do have two children here who are studying at Barron. And, you know, what are they studying and how are they? How's their experience?
Sure. So I have four kids. Girl, boy, boy, girl, and our first boy and our last girl attend here. So JP is a senior this year studying plastics engineering as well as the IBE program, which I never can remember what those initials stand for.
Interdisciplinary Business and Engineering.
I knew somebody would tell me. and Meg, our youngest, is studying biology. The campus is wonderful. The people have been first class, and the people that we hire at Viking Plastics have all been very successful. And so we knew if our kids, you know, applied themselves and did the right things that they would get a great education here, and we're happy with their experience here. So it's been good.
Well, thank you. And you're being modest because both of your children are very high performers, and they're doing exceptionally well here.
My wife likes to point out that they're the most like her, and the other two are more like me.
Okay. Well, Sean, do you have any favorite professors or memorable experiences from your time here at Barron?
Yeah, I mean, where do you start, right? I mean, I met my wife here, so you got to acknowledge that. I mean, that was a great thing for me to have happen in my life, was to meet her. And she was in biology, so the plastics and biology connection there. But I remember my first semester, of course, you come out of high school and you're taking these AP classes, and they're kind of preparing you for, hey, they're not going to be soft on you. And I had a history class with Dr. Frankfurter, you know, and he wrote the book, right? So it's not like you're just dealing with people teaching from the book. The guy wrote it. So, you know, the idea that I had to put in some extra effort there, because there was no, you know, just kind of getting one over on this guy, right? And I really appreciated that he dug that in deep for me right out of the gate. And another thing that
Frankfurter, by the way, I'll just add, I mean, he retired a few years ago, still remains engaged, but Dr. Frankfurter was a great history professor,
yeah,
and
absolutely,
like you said, wrote the book, so helped students to very high standards.
And you know, it didn't matter that it was the history of what you were writing, but how you wrote it, and your grammar, and how you followed the conventions. It was, you know, it woke me up to the fact I need to be on my A game. And I wanted on the dean's list every year, so, you know, it was a challenge for me in that first semester. So, and it's funny how that works out. But I also love the connection that there are people from industry that came back to academia to bring that perspective. And I valued that with, you know, my plastics professors and others, who they not only had that theoretical knowledge that they could impart, but also the, you know, okay, all these inputs are tough to manage when you're in a manufacturing environment. There's lots of things that are going to happen that are not in this book that you're going to have to deal with. And so we're educating you to think, mm-hmm. you know, to, there might be multiple answers to this question, and you're going to have to figure out what is the most correct one for this current set of criteria or situation or whatever it was. And being able to reflect on that as you do engage in 20 years of your career, and it's like, wow, there's not always just a simple, clear-cut answer. And I think I was prepared for that well by Mr. Beaumont and, you know, Mr. Johnson, Johnson, and others. So it was good.
You know, that's one of the transitions that you just constantly see, and you like to see as a faculty member. It doesn't matter what the discipline is that students coming in, and I remember being there as well, you think everyone knows the answers in this world. Well, that's just not the case.
Right.
And that's why we come here and we learn about complexity of a whole different variety of subjects, and we go out into the world and solve problems. Well,
just,
I want to
comment on you know, how this all ties together. So there are certain colleges that really do a great job of preparing our future workforce on a hands-on basis. And there's other universities do a great job from an engineering basis, but I think the blend, especially at Penn State Barron, the blend of having an engineering-based education and having the practical ability to be hands-on with the machines, with the equipment, really prepares a number of individuals for a great career. And if you look at, you know, your graduation rate and you know how highly sought after kids are, I think it's a testament to your program, so it's well done.
That really embodies, I'd say, you know, the philosophy you may hear us use it a lot in terms of open laboratory. The idea is, you know, its fundamental core is we've got this great academic institution, a Penn State University degree that you get here. But on top of that, we want all of our students working with and experiencing real-world problems by the time they get out the door. That's a hard thing to achieve. I can't say we're 100% where we'd like to be, but that's something that characterizes us, and it comes out of that thinking that we've got. I just wanted to ask you the question, Kelly. You got involved, or you purchased Viking Plastics in 2006. What led to that decision? How did you come to that juncture in your life?
I started my career at DuPont and then joined a company called Huron Plastics in the Detroit area that was actually owned by my father. And he was a majority owner. He had bought it from the previous owner and did very well, ended up selling that business in 1998. And I said, you know, if I could have a career similar to him, I'd be pretty amazing. And so I joined Viking in 2000. It was owned by a private equity group along with a couple other businesses. And the business was up for sale. They're trying to sell all the businesses at the same time. And I kept sending them letters saying I'd really like to buy the Viking Plastics business by itself. And I was lucky enough in 2006 to be able to make that happen with help from a lot of advisors and my family. And as Sean mentioned, we survived the 2008-09 mm-hmm. recession as a owner of a company. That's not when you want to own a company.
Yeah, two years later, yeah, we're in the midst of
when nobody wants to buy anything and you know, everybody wants to still be paid. And really, you know, I think my career background with DuPont and working for other companies, other private equity groups, really prepared me well to understand what needed mm-hmm. to be done. And I had a great team that surrounded me, and we were able to make a lot of things happen. You know, we bought the business in China in 2008, bought the business in Brazil in 2011, mm-hmm. and really put us in a nice position to be able to be a global supplier to our automotive customers.
Well, now we're coming out of yet another crisis. It seems like we've got a real large one in this country, in this world, every 10 years, which is, of course, the pandemic. And we're still in the pandemic, but things are improving. I mean, how have you fared, and what's the future look like?
Yeah, so the pandemic, it was kind of interesting. We knew of it and saw some of the governmental actions early because of our relationship in China. So our general manager in China called us in, you know, January and said, hey, the world is going to be shutting down in the next 4 weeks. He literally got on one of the last Delta flights out of China, him and his wife and young son in February. And so we were early on with, you know, ordering masks and getting some of the PPE needed to keep our employees safe. It's like anything else. You've got to be able to forecast. You've got to be able to make the best estimate of what's going to happen and then run the business. We had a very difficult Q2 in 2020 just because everybody did. Volume stopped. But since then, things have rebounded pretty nicely. We've, in the automotive industry at least, had, you know, 6 months of challenges mainly due to semiconductor availability. So when the auto companies shut down, they, in their infinite wisdom, said they didn't need any semiconductors.
Yeah.
And it takes, you know, 26 weeks to make them. And so now all of a sudden we can't make them because we didn't forecast them. So it's been, you know, every day is a challenge, mm-hmm. right? The challenge is, are you making enough money? Are you saving enough money? Are the customers demanding too much? But with a good team of people and a clear vision of where we want to go, it's been a good couple of years.
It's a surprise every day for us as well, and they're really unexpected at times.
Yeah.
It was hard to predict this one. I wanted to hit one last subject, and that's, you know, the plastics industry is under a lot of pressure right now. Plastics pollution, and we hear the stories every day in the news. But there's also, manufacturers are looking at this, and are very serious about it, in my experience. I mean, what's your perspective on the pressure on recyclability, sustainability? What are you being asked to do? What are the things you're doing as a corporation in that regard?
Sure. So we have a fairly simple strategic plan, which is to grow our sales, eliminate waste, which kind of goes back to the mm-hmm. culture discussion, build a culture of continuous improvement, and enhance the value for all our stakeholders, not just the shareholders, but also the employees, the customers, the community, and our supply base. And then underneath each one of those strategic elements, we have a visionary thought. So under the elimination of waste, for example, we have this visionary thought of zero pellet waste. Mm-hmm. So wouldn't it be great if someday we got to the point where every pound of material came in, went out in the form of a good product to our customer? It didn't go in the landfill. It didn't go down the sewer drain. It didn't go out in recycling. It didn't go out in the trash can. It went out in the form of a good product. And having that clear strategy and then having a visionary thought that everybody can understand helps them make decisions on a daily basis on how do we be better, mm-hmm. you know, citizens, better community supporters around recycling, around reuse, around reduction of using our resources. So from a company standpoint, we've been a little bit ahead of that game. From an industry standpoint, on, you know, for example, the automotive side, we have been using recycled materials for probably 25 years, but nobody wants to talk about it because the image in the car may be, well, that's not a good enough part, mm-hmm. right? But we've been using recycled materials. We're constantly sampling recycled materials in our products that we serve to our customers. And so it is a real challenge, but the automotive industry especially has been a pretty strong supporter of that and pushing that in the right direction.
Thanks.
Sean, I mean, I don't know if you've got some...
Yeah, I think the challenges are one of variety. I mean, there are tens and tens of thousands of grades of any of these resins, you know, amongst a dozen classes, right? And as you probably experience here at Barron, people were coming to you trying to figure out, how do we do separation? How
Absolutely.
Do we create clean streams? I mean, when you're dealing with highly refined materials with great properties, and then you blend in a contaminant, quote unquote, right? Something that's different, you know, then it is a struggle for engineers to say, well, what am I really going to yield from this product from a performance standpoint? Is it going to be consistent? I was reading about some companies that have launched some initiatives to try to get the community to do the recycling. I mean, we know the numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, with the arrows going around it. But within each of those buckets, there's a mix. And I think you're going to see a lot of, governmental investment with the initiatives, subsidizing those efforts. We, from an engineering team, get not too much pressure on it, like from our engineers that are counterparts at Ford, they tend to, you know, hey, we want this prime grade of something. But I can feel it in the literature. You can see it in some of the communities, especially on the coast, where there's just a heightened awareness to anything making it out into the waterways. So we don't want, you know, the sea otters dying from anything. So I think it's going to become a bigger part of our mind share space. We're going to have to be thinking about it. And the challenges are, you know, we have so many variety of plastics, and how do we separate it from the others, right? So
I think there's a lot of policy around it. There's right. going to be a lot of standardization. You are seeing countries that have moved to a much higher recycled content than you do in the U.S. We get into a whole conversation mm-hmm. around that. But, yeah, it's coming. We can see it in the questions that we're hearing from industry and the type of research that's coming here. It is a part of our everyday life now as well.
2 years ago, prior to COVID, most of the articles regarding plastics were, I would classify them as negative. The reporting was... we need to, you know, eliminate plastic straws, single use, just the negative side of it. Once COVID hit, everybody realized that plastics is an enabling technology. There are things that we have today that cannot be produced with other materials that are as easy to recycle or as easy to produce or as cost effective to produce. So it's like, it's messy. You know, one of my professors always said, it's messy, you know, it's complicated. Our job is to try to work our way through it and sort it out.
Well, gentlemen, this has been a fascinating conversation. I've thoroughly enjoyed it, but I'm going to give you the last word. Anything you'd like to add?
Sure.
No, we appreciate the opportunity to be here. You know, I appreciated coming back home to Penn State Barron and being able to represent Viking. It's one of the things that's a challenge, right? You build up this career and you do some things that you're really excited about, and then you get to go out and talk about them, but they're not mine. These are things that I talk about with our company. Are part of a team of people, and Kelly alluded to that a little bit earlier. Folks on my team that listen to this, I want them to take pride in it, and in our community as well. I'm here in northwestern Pennsylvania for a reason. I see opportunity. When people see negative things about us, I see the positive things, and working at Viking is one of those positive things for me and working with the people. So appreciate your time.
Really well said. My guests today have been Kelly Goodsell, CEO and President of Viking Plastics, and Sean Gross. We're very proud of you as one of our graduates, Sean, and
thank you
for taking the time today. I'm Dr. Ralph Ford. You have been listening to Barron Talks.
Thank you.
Thank you.